Judge Bill Meyer, I'll be your presiding judge this afternoon. And you all may be seated. Thank you for coming today. My right is Justice Lisa Kerr. She will be one of the panel members. And we have visiting Judge Quinn, who's visiting us and helping us out with this case today. So we will be your panel. And is counsel ready? And clerk, call the case, please.
The court will now call James Richard Fletcher and Michael Allen Taylor versus Bobby Wayne Lindemuth Jr. and Junior's Demolition and Excavation Incorporated. May it please the court, Mr. Russell J. DePalma will argue for the appellant. Mr. Bruce L. James will argue for the appellate.
Counsel ready?
Ready, Your Honor.
All right, let's proceed. Mr. DePalma, it's your microphone.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, 7 years ago, the Texas legislature enacted the TCPA. Since then, and it did so unanimously, it had 141 representatives in favor, it had 31 senators in favor, it had zero votes against. In three legislative sessions since the law was first enacted, it has only changed for to close a procedural loophole. This is the law of Texas, it's the public policy of Texas, and the public policy of Texas, which is because it's an enacted legislative statement. This comes from the Supreme Court, which says Texas legislature enacts public policy, and its enactments reflect Texas public policy. The whole point of the TCPA, because Texas already had enshrined in its constitution certain protections for reputational causes of action. The whole point of the TCPA is to make sure that any cases that are brought for reputational harm have merit. Those that do not survive a TCPA motion to dismiss have no merit by definition. Once the trial court determines that the TCPA case has no merit, that the case to which the TCPA applies has no merit, then the trial court has one duty at that point, and that's to protect the First Amendment freedoms of the defendants who have won the motion to dismiss. Section 27002 of the CPRC talks about kind of the two interests, first protecting First Amendment rights, protecting meritorious cases for reputational harm. But once the trial court finds that there's no reputational harm, that's not a meritorious case for reputational harm, then it has to concentrate on protecting the rights of the people who have been sued, because the Texas legislature said at that point the case has no purpose other than to infringe upon their First Amendment rights. The trial court here did not meet its legislative purpose. It awarded the full attorney's fees for the two local councils who worked for the appellants. It awarded full fees and costs that were associated with defending the lawsuit. It awarded 14 cents on the dollar for fees incurred by the defendants, Jan Mogged, Richard Fletcher, Michael Taylor, for defending a spurious lawsuit. That is an excessively low amount considering the work that had to be done and the proof in front of the district court. The trial court had no evidence to reach the number that it did. We did the math for it in our briefs, and effectively, taking out the costs and like deposition costs and filing costs, taking out those costs that were associated with defending the case, the trial court awarded $22,532.32 on a legal bill of over $160,000. In support of the legal bill, Mr. Chan submitted three separate affidavits. His initial one that proved up all the Arthur Anderson factors and proved up a Lodestar amount. A second one.
May I interrupt you, counsel?
Of course.
With regard to the Lodestar. Supreme Court decide whether or not Lodestar applies anti-SLAPP cases?
It has talked about Lodestar for statutory attorney fee cases.
Did it apply that in anti-SLAPP?
No. Yeah.
Because in the Abrams-Sullivan cases, line of cases, it referred to Lodestar, but only in the sense that that's what the parties agreed to apply.
Correct.
Is there any indication, one way or the other, whether or not Supreme Court's going to say Lodestar applies, or is it just going to use some reasonable attorney's fee standard?
I don't know if you can read the tea leaves unless they expressly say it.
Obviously, I can't read the tea leaves when it comes to, and I slap if you've read those cases.
Right.
But what do you think?
The guess would be, and the best educated guess that I can provide the court, is that it would approve a Lodestar analysis for TCPA cases because it has talked about Lodestar attorney fee analyses when in cases that are where statutory attorney fee shifting is employed.
I guess maybe another way to see if it's even a problem. Did any of the attorneys, any of the sides here disagree with regard to whether or not Lodestar applies, or did you just assume that Lodestar applies and that's how you presented and defended against the issue?
We presented the Lodestar. I believe they defended against it.
Nobody objected to you, so okay.
I like it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chan's affidavits spoke to the reasonableness of all the fees. Also, because this case was decided before Sullivan Abraham and Hirsch Tatum, we discussed the necessity of the fees because that was still an issue at the time. This case came out in 2015. It was decided by the court. The motion to dismiss was decided in October 2015. The attorney's fees hearing was in February or March 2016. So it was before the 2016 cases that reviewed the grammatical language in the attorney fee portion of the statute.
Tell me again the date of the hearing you're talking about. You said 16?
Early 2016 was the attorney fee hearing.
Early?
Yes. I believe it was March, but I might be incorrect. It might have been around February 19th. So it came out before the later Texas Supreme Court cases that discussed the Sullivan Abraham case that discussed how to apply incurred defending in the lawsuit language and going through the latest anticipated analyses for how I was going to try to make sense of the statute.
The justice and equity provision, basically?
Yes, the justice and equity provision.
And what a comma can do?
Right, the power of a comma. And because we didn't have clarity on that, and we didn't have power and clarity on the justice and equity provision of the statute, we presented it under the notion of reasonable and necessary attorney's fees and backed up all our statements with evidence of why they were reasonable and why they were necessary.
Doesn't Lodestar itself incorporate a necessary aspect?
I believe that's what you said on the remand in the Sullivan case, and arguably it does. And to the extent that it does.
Was it me or was it Apple and all those other Supreme Court cases that said reasonable and necessary in Lodestar?
It was talking about the reasonableness of the fees looking through what the work was done and how the work had to be done. I don't think it said quite as clearly reasonable and necessary as if we were dealing with a 3709 question.
The Supreme Court indicated in those cases that the trial court has the discretion to consider whether the fees were necessary?
The trial court would have the discretion because it's dealing with the Arthur Anderson factors, and to the extent that they apply and the extent that one of the factors works in terms of what the necessity of the outlay is, then yes, it does.
With regard to the other Arthur Anderson factors and IAPL, I noticed that you described them in your briefs. And one I did not see, and that was when talking about the authority of the trial judge to bump up or down amount of fees after they determined the Lodestar and considered those. And then the Supreme Court talked about being able to bump up or down anywhere from 25 to 400%. Bumping down, what would it allow the court to bump down in your view? Because obviously, in your view, you wanted a lot more, and the court granted less. So did the court abide by Arthur Anderson and L. Apple and then use that factor that allowed it to bump down?
There's no evidence that the trial court found the lodestar. There's nothing in the trial court's in the trial court record that indicates what hours it thought were reasonable, the number of hours it thought were reasonable, or the attorney fee that it thought was reasonable. So there's no reason to discuss the 25 to 400% range, which was applying to a class action case in that situation. There was no, or which is what L. Apple was quoting off of. There's no reason to discuss that sort of range and modifier when there's no basis to even discuss it because there has been no lodestar determined. The court's supposed to determine a lodestar. It's supposed to find the number of hours reasonably expended. It's supposed to find the reasonable fee for those hours and multiply the two. There's no indication whatsoever that the court did that. The way we build, there's no way that you can really get something that ends in 32 cents because the bills that we did were quarter-hour bills and unbroken, you know, dollar numbers for each person who billed. So there's really no way that the trial court could get to a $22,532.32 number off of that unless the court was really going to come to a predetermined estimate of what it thought it should award and then work backward, which is what it seemed to do, but we can't tell because there's no basis for that in the record, and there's no discussion of that. And of course, the trial court failed to, despite multiple requests, file findings of fact and conclusions of law. The statute discusses reasonable fees. The statute's purpose is to recompense the defendants who had to file the motion to dismiss. The point of recompensing the motion to dismiss is that it shouldn't cost our clients $140,000 out of pocket to defend themselves against a lawsuit that has no basis. Trial court determined that the lawsuit had no basis. She dismissed all the claims, every last one. And because it's very simple, there is no basis. There is no factual question. There's no factual basis for any of their claims. There's just suspicion, innuendo, and disdain from one party to another. That's not facts. That can't meet the clear and specific evidence test. And yet, our clients have to bear the significant cost of defending themselves despite a statute that was enacted 4 years prior to this lawsuit that's supposed to ensure that they don't, because it finds that if the case does not have merit and cannot go forward and the motion to dismiss is granted, then that means the party that won the motion to dismiss has been harmed.
Well, so, counsel, if the purpose of the statute is basically to make a successful defendant whole, then under what circumstance, I mean, if evidence of attorney's fees is presented, are you advocating that a trial court should just award all of that because it's reasonable? I mean, under what circumstance could a trial court go down from that? It sounds like you're wanting 100%.
We are wanting 100% because the only evidence, the only credible evidence that was before the trial court was that our fees were reasonable. There is no credible evidence before the trial court that they were not. We put in rate evidence that was not just Mr. Chan testifying as to the rate, but also to the rates that were prevailing in this county. There was Rauhauser-McGibney, that trial court approved a $550 an hour rate. The Stratton XCO case from this court approved an $880 an hour rate, which is more than double what my rate was and 30-odd percent higher than what Mr. Chan's rate was.
Wasn't counsel argue with regard to the rates that, or mentioned in his position? What was the rate Mr. Chan was charging? Let me ask you that.
$650.
Were all the attorneys charging $650?
No.
What were some of the other rates? What were the other rates?
I was charging $425.
Were you the lowest?
I was Well, it was really just me and Mr. Chan. We didn't really load up the file.
Well, apparently there were four attorneys or something.
There were some, but I did 80% of the work.
What did the others? You got 650, 450, or 425?
Almost 400, I think, and one was like 250 or 300 because they were younger.
250. So you have, and those were from attorneys on your side, so to speak.
Yes.
Couldn't the trial court consider the $200 rate, your 400 plus rate, and say that would be more reasonable in this case with regard to Mr. Chan's 650 rate? Or does that present conflicting evidence with regard to what would be a reasonable rate?
There would have to be some sort of basis in the trial court's decision to find that rate reasonable. There was not. And that's the problem.
Explain that to me. What do you mean?
The only rates that were posited to the trial court were Mr. Chan's rates, my rate, and the rates that we charged to our firm.
And they're not the same rates?
No, they're not all the same. They differ based on timekeeper, and because I had more appellate experience and more First Amendment experience, I did the bulk of the work. And for 425, based on the Texas Lawyer Survey of DFW attorneys, you're talking about junior partners at major law at the median rate of all across all practices and across all junior partners was. Can I continue? Because
yes,
I think I
please, please
sorry,
complete your sentence.
I lost my yellow across all practice areas was 391. Most of those junior partners have less experience than me, and they haven't handled the appeals and the First Amendment work that I've handled. So 425 off of 391 is not excessive in on any way, shape, or form. We provided neutral evaluations and neutral evidence from articles and surveys regarding what was a reasonable rate. There was not, Mr. James did not posit an actual rate. He posited a range, and then in the briefing, they posited what Bobby thought would be a reasonable rate, which doesn't have any sort of evidentiary value because Bobby is Bobby Wade Lindemood, and Mr. Lindemood is not an attorney. So the only evidence before the trial court was that was competent, because for the other reasons that we've discussed on Mr. James's affidavit, it was unreliable, and we've discussed that in great detail in our briefing. Unfortunately, I'm not going to have time to discuss that right now. But the only evidence before the trial court was that our rates and the work that we did was reasonable. The trial court would have discretion, as Justice Kerr was suggesting, when dealing with conflicting evidence, to resolve it, but there wasn't any that was competent that conflicted with ours.
Mr. De Palma, I know your time's up, but I want to ask you a question that I hope you can answer in just a very brief statement or one sentence. What is the proper amount that your client contends is the proper amount for a penalty? There was $1,000 awarded. There was $2,000 discussed, but you didn't really tell us how much you thought was the right amount.
We posited based on, and we requested in our motion, 25 to 50% of the fee amount.
Thank you. Clerk, would you please add 4 minutes to the response for the appellee? Are you ready, counsel?
May it please the court, I'm Bruce James, and we represented the plaintiffs in the trial court below. We have also our cross appeal, which complains that the trial court should not have dismissed our case under the TCPA. And going back, this case has been on file now since May 7th of 2015, and we've traveled to El Paso and back, and you know, frankly, I forgot some of the facts, but reviewing them, I'm kind of amazed at some of the things that I want to share with you that happened before the petition was filed that we discovered that led us to bring the defamation claim that we did against the three individuals, Michael Taylor, Jan Moggin, and Richard Pletcher. I also called the court's attention that we filed five separate affidavits setting out what we believed, and I firmly believe today, showed a prima facie case of libel per se. We don't know the basis for the trial court's granting the motion to dismiss. So I bear that burden of trying to show to each of you that we did carry that burden of showing a prima facie case. On April 29th, we know that there was a PAC meeting, Protect Colleyville PAC, at which time Mr. Taylor showed up with a 7-page excerpt from a deposition of 175 pages taken back in 2011 of my client, Bobby Lindemuth. So we know what's about to happen is about Bobby Lindemuth, that it was a defamatory statement about my client. He produced those 7 pages with certain lines and yellowing on it that we named during the course of litigation the Taylor handout, because he claimed that he did hand that out and show it to people, including Mr. Fletcher and the husband of Jan Moggett, who said she got it in her affidavit from her husband. In that, later afterwards, an alert, the Colleyville alert was sent out, a voter alert, mysteriously appeared in some mailboxes, was mailed in the United States mails and others. David Medlin, Linda Newton, and Richard Newton, who all testified by affidavit, received copies of it. It was written up in red, bright red ink. It's attached to all of the pleadings, I think. And it alleged sexual misconduct on the part of Bobby Lindemuth. They alleged that he exposed himself at his office through a picture of some sort, alleged he had sex with a prostitute in Las Vegas, and alleged that he had had sex with an underaged female at his home. Mr. Taylor's 7-page handout marked out Mandy Collins' name, the alleged minor. So did the Colleyville voter alert.
But weren't they marked? Wasn't that the name marked out in a different way? It didn't look the same, as I recall.
No, ma'am. I believe it was exactly the same blocking, because our expert David Fitzgerald, a computer expert, said when he blew it.
So there was different blocking, though. But wasn't one black versus the other one was white?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Wasn't one of the blockings white and the other blocking black?
I think that was probably because of Xeroxing. I'm not sure about that. But they were the exact same size. And that was what they reported. And it was the exact same 5 times that Mandy's name appears in deposition. Now, the Colleyville voter alert says it was blocked out because she asked not to be identified. Well, that could only have been known if it was really somebody else, if you believe that defense, that it wasn't us. Then somehow that had to have been transmitted to that person by the only person who knew to block it out in the first instance, Mr. Taylor. So that happened on April 29. On May 1, Mr. Fletcher appeared at City Hall where Bobby Lindemuth was and told him, I hope we can still be friends after this because some bad things are coming out. And at that same meeting on April 29th, the group had decided not to publish it. Not to publish it. So as it was coming out, somehow or another, Mr. Fletcher knew it was coming out. Then on that same day, Miss Moggett showed up at the house of the Newtons to talk about the Grade Road proposition, and they got in a discussion of the Taylor-Lindemuth contest for the Colleyville City Council that they were running against each other on. And she brought up, you better wait before you vote, because some bad news is coming out about Bobby Lindemuth about in Las Vegas. So she knew it was coming out.
Well, excuse me for interrupting you, but do you draw a distinction for defamation purposes between what we're calling the Taylor handout versus the voter alert? Are they both defamatory in your view?
In my opinion, they are, Your Honor. The problem was we didn't know about the Taylor handout, if it was, in fact, the Taylor handout that was first shown to
But if that was what, for example, if that was what Ms. Moggett was referring to, was the Taylor handout, but your position is that the simple fact that Mr. Taylor had excerpts of a deposition that your client gave that he had underlined and didn't otherwise add any editorial comments on for the Taylor handout, you think that that in and of itself was defamatory?
Yes, ma'am, I do.
And it's because of the underlining?
Because of the underlining and highlighting.
Underlining and highlighting.
Yeah.
You don't deny that what was said in those seven pages was true? That was a part of his deposition given in the 211 case? 2011?
Yes, that was his deposition. That was his deposition.
And he was testifying under oath at the time he gave that deposition, wasn't he?
Yes, sir, he was.
And so you're not contesting the truth of what your client testified to under oath?
Not his answers, no.
All right.
Of course not. I was not the attorney of record in that case, by the way, just to make sure. I don't know who was, but it was another case in 2011 arising out of probate of Bobby's dad's will. The alert came out between May 1 and May 4, and there was a confrontation on May 5th of Taylor at the city council meeting, in which both Medlin and Bobby Lindemuth said, "Why did you do this? Why would you publish this? Why would you do it?" That's on the alert. And he responded, would not respond, only said, "Get out of my way." At that same meeting, Bobby had a conversation with Jim Hamilton, who was at the PAC, and told him that he saw the alert at that meeting, not the Taylor handout. So there is some dispute as to really what was handed out at the meeting at the PAC. Jim Hamilton said it was the alert. He saw the red writing and everything, which was not on the Taylor handout that was attached to his affidavit.
Does the record indicate how many people were members of this PAC, the PAC?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
How many people were does the record indicate how many people were members of the PAC?
I know there were more than 20.
Did the record indicate how many of those members were at this meeting?
No, I don't believe the record shows that, but we do know that Jim Fletcher was there, Jim Hamilton was there, of course Taylor was there, and Jan Moggett's husband was there. And she admitted in her affidavit she got at least the Taylor handout from her husband.
With regard, one of the witnesses, and I apologize for not remembering the name, you just alluded to him, where he apologized and said he disagreed with using the alert, I saw it at the meeting, or something along that line. I don't remember.
Yes, he did.
Which person was that?
Jim Hamilton.
Jim Hamilton. The quote said something about, "I disagreed with them or they." Did he specify who them or they were?
It's not in the record who them or they was, but he was there when they confronted Councilman Taylor at that time. It was at that same meeting. So I took it to refer to Taylor and his campaign.
And his campaign, the suit is against three individuals, so to speak, that were at the PAC meeting. Let's concede that. Assuming arguendo they're at the PAC meeting, rely on the record for that. But there's no indication from anybody of those three people as being the actual people who disclosed, drafted the alert. They just said they, and it could have been up to 20 people at the meeting. Do you understand what I'm asking?
I believe he said, "I told them not to publish it, or we decided not to publish it." And I took that to mean the PAC as a whole decided not to publish it. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Maybe it wasn't a good question. That's fine.
Mr. James, I'd like to talk with you just briefly about the constitutional aspects of what's involved here that apply through the anti-SLAPP legislation. What significance do you believe fact that these items that are the basis of the claims for libel and slander were utterances in the form of exchanges in a political race? a race for public office?
Well, I think the rule is that because Bobby Lindenmuth was running for office, he's a public figure, and the actual malice standard would have to apply.
And what about the actual, not just the actual malice, but the constitutional writings in the Supreme Court that have in the past left to the political debate to ferret out the truth in a political contest?
Well, Judge, I believe in all of the political flyer cases, and there are a number of them that we cited in our cases.
Yes, sir.
Each one of them addressed that if you are going to be ferreting out these facts, I mean, they've got to be truthful. And the facts in this case were, if you take what Bobby Lindenmuth said, did you have sex with a prostitute in Las Vegas? That's incorrect. Then the flyer says, Bobby had sex with a prostitute. That's not what was said. That is a bald-faced lie from the quote in the defamation of Bobby Lindenmuth from his deposition.
All right, so I take it your answer to my question is that when the Supreme Court's talking about ferreting out the truth in a political sense, it's only applicable in terms of the protection given to the free speech aspect by the Supreme Court if the statement is true, not if the statement is false.
Correct. I would say that's the
case. And the determination of whether it was true or false, the Supreme Court says, is ferreted out through active political debate.
That's true, but and the only thing I would back off is there is a substantial truth formula also there, but I think we go way beyond that. This was not even substantially true.
Okay. Thank you for your response.
And I note, finally, on May 6, Taylor, contrary to his affidavit, had an interview with the Star-Telegram where he said, I was offered the deposition and I didn't want it. 180 degrees deposed. So there's this dichotomy of telling the truth in your affidavit and not in other places. That was what you used to call an admission, but that was a party opponent talking about that. Now, Judge, you just recently, Judge Meyer wrote the Dallas Morning News case and set out.
Why don't you pick that one just because I got reversed?
Already reversed? Really?
I'm glad you fared a surprise.
Really? Well, I didn't know that. Anyway, the trial court's role is not to act as a fact finder and to resolve opposing reasonable inferences. And if you go through our five affidavits, I just can't believe that there is not that quantum of proof that N. Ray Lipsky established for us to show that there was a defamatory statement published against Bobby Lindenmuth that was defamatory per se. Sexual misconduct is a defamatory per se statement. I also wanted to look just a moment. Again, we don't know why the court below decided to grant the motion to dismiss, and look at the actual malice standard for a moment. We believe, number one, affirmatively proclaiming as true what the only evidence at hand, that is Bobby's deposition, affirmatively stated was false, amounts to actual malice. If that's not enough, then Bobby has set it out in his affidavit. Additionally, former Chief Justice Livingston said that it's just a high degree of awareness of the publication's probable falsity. There is evidence that the PACs decided they would not use it. Mr. Tater claims he decided not to use it, although it's been published.
And you're talking with regard to malice?
I'm sorry?
You're talking with regard to actual malice right there?
Yes, I think it is.
Justice Kerr asked, was talking earlier about the Taylor handout versus the alert. You indicated both of them had defamatory comments. With regard to the alert, you said it was the highlighting,
yes,
underlining, et cetera. the alert to be actionable would have to show actual malice too, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Under Sullivan?
Yes.
What in the alert indicates that there was actual malice? What in the underlining or highlighting indicates actual malice?
Well,
ignore the alert. When I'm talking about the handout.
The handout.
I'm sorry. I misstated that.
Judge Quinn, we had in one of our briefs, and I can't point to it exactly, but it's in the record, where highlighting it can be considered to show an emphasis on a defamatory matter. If you go through that, the highlighted part is always the question.
Well, the highlighted part was the question. Is the question defamatory? Was the question inherently defamatory in some way? The attorney's asking the question, did you have sex?
Well,
he highlights, did you have sex? Let's assume that is defamatory for some reason. How does that show actual malice, the highlighting, with regard to the purported defamatory accusation about having sex that's in the question?
Well, it would be a many-step process, but it would show motive, number one, and a lack of care in determining that statement was true or false. That's a two-part step getting towards actual malice. By highlighting that and suggesting that is true when it is false is showing motive to defame.
And you're suggesting that by highlighting it, that is a suggestion it was true.
Even though neither the handout nor the photo alert deleted Mr. Lindemead's denial under oath.
No, I don't believe it did delete them.
I know. But, I mean, I can see how, I guess the mere highlighting of a question, I would find, it would seem to me a lot more indicative of actual malice had whoever did the voter alert also blacked out Mr. Lindemead's answer to the question where he said, no, that's incorrect.
Anyway, my request is to look at our affidavits to see on a step-by-step basis if we did not meet the prima facie case standard that's set out in N. Ray Lipsky. Turning to the attorney's fees issue right quickly, we know from Sullivan versus Abraham that a reasonable fee is one that is not excessive or extreme, but rather moderate.
And I got reversed on, so.
Well, welcome to the club.
Yeah.
What the fee may be rests with the trial court's sound discretion. The trial court's decision is entitled to deference as long as it's not arbitrary, comports with controlling rules and principles, and has evidentiary support. They chose the lodestar method, and I think it's reasonable and necessary now because they chose it under your decision, Justice Quinn, that just recently came out in the remand of the Abraham case. I want to say that, you know, abuse of discretion, as our chief recently said in the McGibney case, does not occur when the trial court bases its decision on conflicting evidence and some evidence of substantive and probative character supports its decision. Recall there were three different law firms seeking to have attorney's fees awarded in this, which had different rates. My testimony, as I recall it, was that there's a reasonable fee in this county is between $150 and $385 an hour, and it should have taken no more than 100 hours to perform that. So it was between $15,000 and $38,500 would have been a reasonable fee, and that's where Judge Womack came in. I think I have to bring up one last question. I know my time is up, but in Abraham versus Sullivan, the court emphasized not only a comma, but the word other, and stated in that by referring to court costs, reasonable attorney's fees, and other expenses incurred, the statute reflects that costs and attorney's fees are expenses and that they must all be incurred in defending the legal action. And that's where we had an issue with the fees on fees, which the Supreme Court has not ruled on yet, to my knowledge. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you for your argument, counsel. Do you have a rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. beg the court's indulgence if I speak a little bit too quickly. Mr. James has brought up a couple of facts that are not in the record. So because they're not in the record, the court should just summarily ignore them.
What facts are those?
Discussing Fletcher confronting Lindemood, which was not in the case. Talking about Lindemood confronting Mike Taylor. Now, that may have been Mr. Lindemood's affidavit, but doesn't have any relevance to it because Mr. Taylor it doesn't show any proof of publication. At its core, and of course, everything that was discussed regarding Jim Hamilton and the voter alert, because Jim Hamilton did not provide an affidavit. There's no way that the court can assign perjury to any statement that Mr. Hamilton made. Therefore, every statement that Mr. Hamilton made is incompetent. And right now, it's coming in through hearsay. That's a defect in substance. It's not a defect in form. And substantive defects in affidavits survive on appeal, even if they were not ruled upon by the trial court. There are a lot of substantive defects in the affidavits that they presented, and we went through them to a great degree in our briefing. I don't want to use too much of my time with that. The court has seen these. This is the handout. This is the alert. Okay. There's no credible evidence that ties any of the defendants to the alert, to making it, publishing it, producing it, any way, shape, or form.
Counsel, would you please mark those as an exhibit that you're holding up and showing to the court, since we sure need that for our record?
I'll make this the alert exhibit one and the handout exhibit two, if that pleases the court.
That'll keep our record complete.
Okay. Without that evidence of publication, there's no defamation. You can't defame somebody if you didn't publish the statement that's allegedly defamatory. That's
what evidence was there in the record? In the record.
In the record.
In terms of who prepared the alert?
None. I don't know where it was. I mean, there's nothing that discusses who prepared the alert other than the expert affidavit of Daniel Fitzgerald, and that affidavit was completely worthless from an evidentiary perspective because he did not testify that he was capable of forensic computer analysis. He did not testify regarding alternate causes. He did not testify regarding his methods and their reliability. And he said that the only person who could have had access to the electronic copy of the Lindemood deposition was Michael Taylor, when Mr. Fitzgerald knew full well that Michael Taylor got that copy from someone else. So you can't have just say one person is the only person who could have done it when he's the end of the chain and then he was sent the information from somebody else. That is not evidence.
Did you object to that affidavit in the trial court?
Yes, on every level.
And how did the court rule?
The court did not rule, but it was, again, it's defects in substance, which...
Therefore, it was a part of the record and still maintained as being a part of what the trial court had the ability to look at in making a decision in this case.
Correct. The trial court could have looked at it, and in fact, if the trial court did and looked at it and took into account our objections even without ruling on them, because, again, they were substantive, not form objections, the trial court correctly dismissed it because it has no probative value.
Just don't know what the trial court did about that because it wasn't a ruling.
I wish I could eliminate that for you, Your Honor, but I cannot.
And so the contention on the part of your opponents, the appellees, that circumstantial evidence indicated that Mr. Taylor got a copy of these excerpts from the deposition, and the fact that he had a copy of those then implies that you can, if you prove that fact that he had a copy, then that fact can be transported into a finding of fact that he prepared the alert.
That would be a logical jump that would take extra steps, not only that he prepared the alert, but that he published it.
And there wasn't any evidence in the record of any of that.
Not a bit.
That he prepared the alert, or that he published the alert, or that he mailed the alert. Anything like that?
Not a stitch.
Okay. So the very basis of the very start of an anti-SLAPP case comes into question as to what was the conduct of Mr. Taylor.
Correct. That does bring in the question, but there have been two other questions, or two other issues. One was that they claimed that the Taylor handout, and may I answer, because my red light went off. One was that they claimed that the Taylor handout was somehow defamatory. This is not defamatory because it contains no statement of fact by Mr. Taylor. These are not statements of fact. These are highlighting and underlining. There is no statement of fact. You cannot have defamation without a false statement of fact. That's Texas law. That's constitutional law. And without that, there cannot be defamation.
All right, counsel. Thank you for your presentation. Your time has expired, and I thank you for your argument to you and opposing counsel. Y'all have both been very thorough in your briefing and in your argument here today. Thank you for your presentation.
Do I deliver these to the clerk?
Yes, please hand those to the clerk. She'll take care of it. And with that, your case is submitted, and you're free to go, and the court will adjourn.